Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. Today, my guest is Peter Carey, one of only two writers ever to have won the prestigious Booker Award twice. His new novel is Parrot and Olivier in America, published by Alfred A. Knopf. Parrot and Olivier in America is inspired by Democracy in America by the French writer Alexis de Tocqueville. Tocqueville came to America in 1831 and wrote his Observations of American Life. It's thought to be one of the first great works of sociology and political science. Peter Carey takes Tocqueville's journey and turns it into fiction, with a big difference. Tocqueville was an aristocrat and talked mostly with other aristocrats. His family was destroyed by the French Revolution. He feared democracy and its effects. Carey calls him Olivier in this book and gives him a traveling companion, Parrot, a servant, working class, who's been in prison in Australia and who speaks for the parts of American life that Olivier just can't see. Peter, tell us, what was it about Tocqueville that attracted you?
Well, you know, I'm Australian, but I'm also, I've got an American passport, an Australian passport. I've been living in New York for 20 years. I'm deeply Australian, but I'm also deeply involved with America and American life. I'm a foreigner, but I'm not a foreigner. I have American children, and it's always a mystery to me. And I get very frightened of this country, of which I have a passport, and angry and afraid. And I was reading Democracy in America, and I'd always understood that Tocqueville was a French aristocrat who came to this country and sort of got it and got American democracy and saw what was great about it. But what I read wasn't quite like that. I found a much more questioning, much more skeptical person. And it took me years in writing this book. Only at the end did I suddenly realize that all my friends who had talked about it, or most of them, had never really read it all. That they'd studied it in school and they'd been or college, and they'd been given the good bits. So all the bits where you find Tocqueville being actually quite reasonably and consistently rather snobbish, why would he not be? And when you see him fearing... Well, what I found was him fearing the things that I was fearing right now. And so every morning I wake up and I am afraid of the consequences of the great sea of cultural crap we are swimming in. It's very, very serious. It's life-threatening. When I find Tocqueville sort of worrying about the same things, I'm very interested. And then the other thing is you see him worried about the future of America, and his concern is not just, you know, he's worried about the rule of the majority, and that for an Australian seems a very reactionary sort of a thing to be, and how horrible that he should be like that. And then you realize that he's really, really worried about an uneducated majority, and you suddenly think the thing that he's really worried about is not that anyone can be president, but that anyone can be president. Tocqueville traveled with another aristocrat, Beaumont, and they talked and talked and talked and argued and argued and argued about America and democracy all the while they traveled. And I thought, wouldn't it be interesting to have another sort of an argument about democracy with two different sides to it, neither one of them being completely right, neither of them being completely wrong.
Now, they are Parrot Larrett, and Olivier, whose name is in fact a whole railroad train of subsequent nobilities and epithets. What is his whole name?
Oh, I cannot remember it even. It's Olivier Jean-Baptiste de Clairel de Gaumont. No, de Bafleur de Gaumont. Yeah. But, I mean, of course, one has to do that if one's to build this character, because he's got to have those names.
Yes.
And the names have to, you know, be consistent with the Normandy or the place that he's born and all of these sort of things. So,
and he's very proud and very traumatized,
yes,
because he's witnessed the lopping of his ancestral tree by the coming of the revolution,
yes,
by the coming of democracy, by the reign of terror.
Yes.
They've been done in by guillotine.
Yes. I come from this little country town in Australia with 5,000 people, mostly working class. And of all the fictional challenges to invent this character, this French aristocrat from the, you know, born in the very beginning of the 19th century, it's a very, very big, scary challenge, but fun because of that. And I thought that my first real insight into his character, something that my invented character could have, which would be consistent with the historical character, was that he was the child of survivors of the terror. And to think of Olivier as being like that enabled me to conceive, to build his character from a very, very solid position. And the other thing that I thought about this is that, of course, it would be quite reasonable for the parents not to talk about it, for it to be a great secret, and for him not to know there had been a revolution, or that his grandfather had been guillotined, or that his parents had only just been saved by the fact that Robespierre himself was sent to the guillotine, and that there would be this sense of loss and trauma in the house. And his sort of in the first bit, he discovers the French Revolution, really, the terror,
and so he fears democracy.
Yes,
and in a sense goes to America to see how the French might be able to weather the disastrous arrival to their country of democracy.
Yes.
Already present, prevalent, dominant in the horrible United States.
Yes. And you see, he's very smart. He understands in a way that the monarchist party doesn't, that there is no turning back, that democracy, it will be the wave of the future and nothing is going to stop it. So his position is, you know, how is he, an aristocrat, to be who he might be in this situation? How might he serve and distinguish himself? How might he play the role of a noble? And also, what can he learn in the United States that would be useful in France to stop them all being swept away by this?
Well, like Tocqueville, your hero has come to America to study the prison systems, mm-hmm. and which are more humane than the French prison system. And that's what we are exposed to in this novel, that our backgrounds put us in many different prisons, mm-hmm. and that our aristocrat Olivier is in a prison of his own designed by nobility, and Parrot, his servant, has lived, in fact, many lives, each of them a prison. Mm-hmm. Olivier is guaranteed a happy future by his prison, whereas Parrot is guaranteed the same sense of loss, of futility, however many times he restarts. Mm. And that's what we find in this America, a place where there is so much bounty that people making a fresh start can in fact amass as much as they need and find themselves in control of their lives in a way that poor Parrot has never been able to be.
I'm not sure that one would say that necessarily that Olivier is guaranteed happiness, because the risk of his class and his position in life is considerable. I mean, there's a considerable risk. I mean, and although he comes to study prisons, it's really an excuse to get him away from another revolution that's just happened in France and maybe his mother fears for his life. But that's quite correct. I think the thing about Parrot's consciousness of himself and where he is that by the end of the book, I think Parrott would think of himself as not being in a prison. He would think of himself, if people in that period, and I hope they didn't use the term the American dream, that he would be living proof of the possibility of American democracy. But we would think possibly that the future has other things in store for him and that perhaps his confidence is not necessarily well placed.
I'm speaking to Peter Carey about his new novel, Parrott and Olivier in America. This story of the mid-18th century New World adventures of Olivier, a coddled French aristocrat, and his English servant, Parrott, reopens the American debate, the debate about democracy, the debate about what happens to art in a democracy. You described our situation as life-threatening, but in fact, it seems to me to be sensibility-threatening. And that is what Olivier seems to know, that sensibility is a matter of life and death.
Yes, I was about to correct you, but yes, exactly that. That sensibility is, well, not only sensibility and the intellect, the ability to think, the ability not just to read the back of a cornflakes packet, but to be able to read and reason, the ability to not be distracted by the entertainments that our sort of society did and will and more effectively produces continually to stop us thinking. And what's it called? Is it the Worldwide Wrestling Federation or you know, where these great sort of enactments of, you know, rage and resentment and whatever take place. We've allowed ourselves to become stupid. We've come to accept, firstly, you know, if you're going to have a democracy, and if you are to have an electorate, it has to be an educated electorate. If you feed it with poison, which we're doing, if you feed it with Fox News, and if you treat the news as entertainment, you'll have a very stupid electorate. And if you have a very stupid electorate, you're going to be in a lot of trouble.
Although Parrott comes from a background in which he does not know his mother, he's been raised by a very plucky, itinerant English printer father. He's been exposed to extraordinary vicissitudes, not least of which has been the daily emptying of a chamber pot from a hidden engraver. Why hidden? He's a forger. What is he forging? Well, Frank notes, the revolutionary notes that they hope will flood and destroy the revolution. Given his background, isn't it interesting to discover that he knows a great book? For him, a great book is beautifully bound and engraved, but that's led him to understand the beginnings of greatness.
Yes. The curious thing, and that's a considerable part, I suppose, of the bone of the book, what lies underneath the drama, is that from a very early age you can feel that Parrott really wishes to be an artist. And one feels at the beginning that he really can be. And I would think that his great drive in life is to be that. So he's very interested in greatness and very self-critical. And I think one of the most, for me, because I sort of think I discovered this at the same time he did, that he could not be an artist. And I really did, at that stage, I still thought he might be. But he will be finally, you know, a very important person in the production of great art.
Well, it's one of the most fascinating parts of the book. Parrott and Olivier have come to Manhattan of, what is it, the 1830s.
Very early 1830s, yeah.
And there is a downtown scene. Lo and behold, there too. We've got a horrible drama about the revolution in France. Mm-hmm. We've got an extraordinary French-born experimental artist who's doing rather Francis Bacon-like things. And we have, as well, people living by their wits or by insurance scam, guaranteed by a proto-version of some of the housing crises that we've witnessed in our own time. So the more things change, the more things stay the same.
The housing crisis part of it, I mean, how could one use the word lucky about that? But I had to figure out how this woman painter, Mathilde, who is a character who doesn't get talked about a lot, yeah, when generally you've got to deal with Parrot and Olivier, but she's a character I'm very, very proud of, and I love her work, and I love her paintings, and I love her spirit, and how am I going to get her some money? I needed her to get some money. And I spent a lot of time talking to people and talking to historians, and in the end I sort of figured out, well, she's going to burn down houses, which she's going to have insured. And then I had to figure out how a woman could buy a house, and then how she... what would happen after the first fire, and what would she have to do? And then I had to think about the motives of a banker who would actually lend this person money.
Yes, the banker who lends her the money is, in fact, her insurer. Mm-hmm. yes, you sense the beginning of a kind of cultural entropy there.
Well, it's also, of course, a time of great sort of financial problem between the bank and the First Bank of the United States and President Jackson about the control of the people's money and who's working for who and so on.
I'm Michael Silverblatt, and you're listening to Bookworm from the studios of KCRW. I'm talking with Peter Carey, author most recently of Parrot and Olivier in America, published by Knopf. We'll continue after this short break. I'm Michael Silverblatt. This is Bookworm, and I'm talking with Peter Carey about Parrot and Olivier in America. Olivier is a spoiled French aristocrat. Parrot is his beleaguered English servant. Together, they journey to America. It's a book that takes up the democratic debate, but let me say that it takes it up in prose so beautiful that I felt that I was experiencing for the first time the complicatedness of being an American for the first time in a long time in our literature. And one of the things that Americans have dropped, you see, no one, it seems to me, is attempting to write the great American novel or to find the great American voice. That one of the things that's dropped out of American literature is the question, what is an American? And in this novel, we meet a whole gallery of American types, in particular Godefroy, a Connecticut farmer and businessman, and his beautiful daughter, Amelia. And Olivier seems to have fallen equally in love with each of them.
I mean, I took them to be both really rather cultured people. They were not, as Americans, they were certainly not uninterested in culture. And yeah, she particularly, I would think of, you know, she's somebody who, Olivia is rather upset that she's teaching in this little school in Connecticut, as grand people sometimes did and do. And she's teaching the novels of Jane Austen, which Olivier thinks is an awful waste of time. I mean, these are sort of contradictions. He's meant to be, he thinks he's a very cultured man, but he can't see the function of, he would, being French, he would think it was better to study philosophers than to read English novels, for instance.
And the father has raised a particularly elegant onion on his farm, the old farm. Mm. How old could it be in Connecticut? And he wants to take out a patent on it. He's gently dissuaded by the town council that yes, you can't, in fact, patent an onion. And yet, at the center of the novel, he holds a slice of onion to the light and describes the world as seen through an onion's lens in unforgettably beautiful prose, the prose of a businessman, highly cultured, who loves his work. In fact, here it is, a little scene in which Godefroy, the onion expert, businessman, takes out his penknife, and here is Peter Carey reading the section from opening his silver penknife.
He was swift as a rat in the moonlight, opening his silver penknife, making two quick cuts, and removing from the onion's heart a good single slice, about a quarter of an inch thick. This he held up between thumb and forefinger before the window.
"Is it not beautiful in the sunshine?" he said.
"Indeed," said Olivier.
"You will think it a peculiar lens through which to view the world."
"It is singular."
"It is the robes of saints," said Godefroy. "Do you see it?"
"No."
"It is cool and watery white, edged with bishop's purple. And look, Mr. Garmont, at that fiery nub of spring green at its centre." Mr. Garmont stood, perhaps to be better convinced of its majesty. "Now," he cried, "look further at the industry this humble fellow fathers." Outside the window I could see the onion maidens everywhere, their thighs and ankles, their straw bonnets bright against the dark black soil, the cello dark and urgent in its longing. Surely someone must say something.
Peter Carey, reading from Parrot and Olivier in America. The novel is extraordinary because suddenly we have a paean to the onion, and of course this is a form of American art, advertising. The proud owner speaking in elaborate tongues virtually about his product. But, you know, where is the poetry? Where is the painting? Where is the art? Will it be sponsored in a culture that can only reckon its qualities by the amount of money, the amount of material goods amassed?
Yes.
And this becomes the question of the novel as it is still in America, as we watch more and more the books we value become the books that sell the most, not the books most highly praised, as we watch even a decline of criticism of the movies, where critics praise the movies that make the most money.
Absolutely.
Rather than the ones that are of the highest quality. What will happen if we stop having great art, Peter?
Well, we will be a poor, diminished people who are addicted to cheap entertainments in which we can act out our resentments and the psychodramas of our lives. For a start, we'll be more stupid. I was thinking, listening to what you were saying, that I'm not making this up either. There is a sort of a... I have heard a publisher, not anyone who publishes me, discuss a category of fiction which is called faux fiction. I mean false fiction. Something that is presented and sold as literature and bought as literature, but is in fact not. Sort of, I think, Nabokov called poshlust. Was that a word that
exactly.
he used? Something that seems like art and that it isn't.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there's an awful lot of that going on, and that is something that Olivier would have quite correctly feared. And there is another thing that is at work here and which you are working against when you talk about language and the line of the novel, the river of prose. And when you talk about that, you're a very unusual person in the United States and would be in Britain or Australia or Canada as well, in that you are looking at what makes art art. Somehow or other, we seem to have come to understand that a novel is a plot synopsis. And so you will forever find, you know, the reviewing of books in this country to be mostly occupied with plot synopsis. This happens and that happens. And then as if somehow the story was art and that was to retell the story was to understand the art. So we are already, you know, approaching the thing that there is to be got from, or to be utilitarian about it, art, or the pleasure and beauty of it, by completely not ever once discussing what it might be.
Mm-hmm.
This seems to me a huge, huge loss to us and an impoverishment of our lives. I think it doesn't have to be like this. I think we learned Shakespeare at school. I wasn't even very bright. You know, I mean, I wasn't very literary. I failed English literature in high school. And yet I learned Shakespeare. I didn't identify with Shakespeare. It wasn't about me, but I did learn the language, whether I wanted to or not, and I carried it with me like I carry the Christian Bible with me. And kids can learn these things. They don't have to identify. It doesn't have to be about them. Teachers can teach. The education of our children is the most important thing in life. The teachers should be being paid more than hedge fund traders. Because what do we value? Because when this all comes tumbling down, when our stupidity has killed us, it's going to kill the hedge fund managers as well. It's going to kill all of us.
One of the great moments of Parrott and Olivier comes at its climax when, in a sense, Olivier understands, we don't see him die, that he doesn't want to live in the world, that he can't live in the world, that his nobility has made him unreceptive and unfeeling, often, to other human beings and their states, and yet his refinement has made him understand that however great these engravings that Parrott is now showing him, he knows they're not great art. They may be as good as you can get, but they're mere commercial art. In a sense, he disappears from the novel because his breeding has rendered him unequipped for the world that America stands for.
Yes, he cannot be an American. He cannot live and breathe in America. He will return to the place that he escaped from. And we don't quite know what will happen to him.
What will happen to him? He seems to disappear into thin air.
Well, he does. I mean,
a trick of art enables his disappearance into thin air, about which we will say next to nothing. But what will you say about his status at the end of the novel?
What will I say?
Yes.
Not a thing.
I've been talking with Peter Carey, author most recently of Parrott and Olivier in America, published by Knopf. Thank you, Peter, for joining me.
Thank you.
You can comment on today's show or read an excerpt from Parrott and Olivier in America at kcrw.com/bookworm. You can podcast this program, share it with a friend, or embed it on your blog with a click of a button on our new media player at kcrw.com. My co-producer is Melinda Siegel. Alan Howard is associate producer. The technical director is Mario Diaz. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
As you ramble through the pages, books will take you through the ages, back to days of old when knights were bold and...
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. You can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcast the most recent ones from our website. Go to kcrw.com/bookworm. Plus copies are available. For ordering information, call 310-450-5183.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air, new music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.